This is Jim Menick. I'm the coach at Hendrick Hudson High School and a former parent judge myself. And I know that the first question you have is, what have I gotten into? With other high school activities, you drop your kids off somewhere and you go back later and you pick them up. And that's the end of it. Or maybe once in a while you go and watch the game. Forensics is different. This activity, unlike almost every other high school activity, cannot run without parents. Coaches cannot be in two places at once, and that happens often, that there will be tournaments in two different states, much less two different high schools. And I'll need chaperones to help out. And also we need to cover the judging. Every time I send a number of kids, and the number changes, to a tournament, a certain judge ratio is required. So I can't do it without parents. None of us can do it without parents. Now, first of all, keep in mind that you're not alone in this. Other parents are also doing it from other schools. Other parents are judging your kids at your school. And this is going to remain the case because unless high schools start spending football team money on debate, we're going to need those parent judges. In my experience, even despite that aspect of it, no kids and no teams do particularly well without parental support. It just doesn't happen. Now, the good news about Lincoln Douglas, and we're going to be talking about Lincoln Douglas LD debate, is that this particular activity was created so that you could judge it. The rationale for LD was to move away from the kind of debate that existed at the time. And that kind of debate, which still exists, is called policy debate. Now, this was decades ago, but the sponsors of policy debate went in and watched some rounds at a tournament and couldn't understand a thing that was going on because these kids were talking so fast. They weren't talking fast like I'm talking fast now. This is not what I mean by talking fast. They were talking fast like... And that's barely an exaggeration. Not only that, but if you could understand what they were saying, the level of the material that they were speeding, bouncing around with was so technical that it was really beyond the ability of the average person to just walk in, listen to what was going on, and make a judgment about it. And the National Forensic League, responding to this problem, and this was conceived of as a problem, which is not to say that there is anything intrinsically wrong with policy debate. Policy debate is a great activity, don't get me wrong, but it is an activity that can only be adjudicated and participated in by people who are pretty dedicated to it. And the NFL said, what we need is an activity for the rest of us, an activity that the average intelligent adult could walk into it, listen to it, make a determination of who had done the best arguing. And as a result, Lincoln Douglas debate was created. So, first thing, and one of the most important things that you have to keep in mind, was that this activity was created especially and primarily so that you could judge it. It is the intrinsic nature of the activity that it be accessible to parents. I'm not saying that at all levels of Lincoln Douglas debate that it is accessible to parents. This may be a flaw with Lincoln Douglas that at some of the varsity levels, it's gotten too fast and it's gotten very technical, but you're not going to be there. You don't have to worry about that. Because LD, at the initial level, the level that you will be judging at, it's not about speed and technical tricks or special stuff that you have to learn in school. Now, this is an activity about kids convincing you that they are right about something. The activity is all about the convincing. If they don't convince you, how can you be wrong? Either you got convinced or you didn't. Now, I have a top 10 list for debaters. My number one on the top 10 list is judge adaptation. That is, convincing the judge, no matter who the judge is, that you are right. Doesn't matter if it's a parent judge or a college kid judge or an upperclassman judge or a coach. Convincing that judge that you are right. In other words, I say to my kids that the number one job they have is playing to the audience. And you, parent judge, are the audience. By the way, this skill of playing to the audience, presenting material to your listeners in such a way that they can understand it, is a really good life skill to have. I think this is one of the great things that Lincoln Douglas does. Now, I ask you, do not be intimidated by everything I cover here, and I do have to cover a lot of material. This is too much for one session. I used to do this as a lecture in a classroom, and it would take forever. And people would have questions, and we'd just go on and on. And it's more than you can really take in one fell swoop. I advise you to listen for a while, take a break, come back. Don't try to do this all at once. And maybe even come back to it later, after you've done it a little bit, for a refresher. Anyhow, there are also written handouts. They are online. They are probably at the same place you got this, and I'll give you specific details later on where to get them. If you got this some other way other than just on my website, we'll talk about those. And most important, there is a very, very good follow-through after this lecture. Perfect follow-through to make this stick in your head. We'll get to that. What I want to do is start out with just the general idea of what goes on at a tournament and what is expected of a parent judge. Now, Lincoln Douglas is one-on-one debate. In other words, it's just, you know, two kids in the room versus each other, and they have a new topic every 2 months as a general rule. So just when they start understanding this topic, they get the next topic. And at every debate tournament that they go to, they are expected to debate both sides. So it's not as if they get to pick the side that they like, and that's the one they go with. They have to be able to argue both sides. So we are trying to teach them the skill of argumentation rather than partisanship. Generally, these topics revolve around the problems of an individual versus a group. In other words, individual rights versus group rights, the rights of an individual in society versus the rights of society as a whole. And we try to make these topics balanced. We don't try to do them in such a way that one side really always is right. They should be the kind of topics that are very hard to say what's right and what is wrong categorically. Some of the topics that we have debated in the past, and these do come up again, there are some standard areas that we are in often, would be capital punishment is justified, it's okay to preemptively attack a country, a rogue nation that's developing nuclear arms, the U.S. is justified in intervening in foreign conflicts, my personal favorite, which is that no government is better than bad government. So these are broad, big, and sort of irresolvable. So what do you do at a tournament? Well, first of all, it's a casual activity. Your kids should be dressed like little lawyers, but you can dress like a criminal. Well, you can dress in your normal casual clothes. And you're going to hang out in a judge's lounge. Most tournaments, we have a place for the adults to go, where they can relax, have some coffee and snacks and whatever, and maybe comfy chairs, if there are any comfy chairs in the high school. And every so often there will be the announcement of a next round. And these rounds are announced by the distribution of schematics, a breakdown of who is judging whom and who is debating whom. Now, most of the time in Lincoln Douglas, what we have are called double flights. So each round consists of two flights, an A flight and a B flight. Now, the reason we do this is to get the most bang for the buck. So you would be the judge, and you would go into room 101, and in your A flight, you would judge two debaters, and in your B flight, you would judge a different two debaters. And what you do here is the only thing you have to make sure that is you do not judge the wrong people. So your A flight, you can't just mix and match these four kids. So the A people have to judge each other. The B people have to judge each other. And at the end of the B flight, after both flights have taken place, you bring your ballot back to the ballot table. And I guess I should have said this. After you get the schematic, the first thing you do is go get a ballot. There is a table usually outside the tab room where all the tabulations are being done. And outside that room is a table, and there's your ballots. You pick up your ballot, get your name checked off, go to the room, judge both flights, write up the ballot, and I'll explain that shortly, and then go back to the table and bring back your ballot. Then go back to the judge's lounge and have a cup of coffee. We do ask that you do some timing of the round. Now, timing used to be very complicated because back in the day, the only person who seemed to have a timer was the judge. Nowadays, all the kids have timers too, so mostly you're just keeping them honest. But it is a good idea to bring a little timer, a little kitchen timer from Radio Shack or something like that, just so you can keep track of the time that is elapsing. But most of the time, the kids will time each other, even novices, except maybe at the very, very beginning, even novices nowadays will time themselves. Another thing that we ask you to do, and this thing is pretty essential, and that's take notes. I'm going to give you some specific directions on how to take notes. I mean, it is a certain format to the way the round is run, and there is a certain format to the way notes should be taken, or at least a format that makes it easy for you to take notes. We ask you to take notes because I don't know how you can really follow what's being said. If they're saying a lot of good things, you want to take some notes so you really have a record of who said what, because you're going to be there for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes or something. You can't really hold it in your head. Also, it looks like you're paying attention. I mean, sometimes it's hard to take notes and you're sort of concentrating. But if you're not taking notes and you don't look like you're taking notes, the kids will think you're just daydreaming. So if you do nothing else, just pretend to take notes. By the way, your kids are also taking notes. This is called flowing, by the way. You flow the round. I flowed the round. Here's my flow. Your kids take notes. Your kids are going to be the best note takers in America. By the time they graduate high school, they are going to sail through college lectures because they could take a note on anything. You'll get pretty good at it, too, if you do it for a while. And the other thing that we ask you to do is those ballots that you picked up, we ask you to write up a ballot and submit it. You don't have to talk to the kids. You don't have to disclose who won or who lost. As a matter of fact, there are some leagues where it is forbidden for you to disclose who won or who lost. You don't have to give them a critique. We do ask that you be nice and friendly. I mean, sometimes I tend to be the worst at this. I just sort of sit there and grimace at them. But that's because I'm really concentrating and not because I'm a grimacer. But there are very few pressures we're really putting on you in these rounds, especially considering that, for the most part, you will start out judging novices who are very unlikely to put any pressure on you. They don't know much more than you do. As a matter of fact, they probably know a lot less. Anyhow, let's go into the actual details of what comprises Lincoln Douglas debate. As I said, it's one-on-one. We have a name for Lincoln Douglas. We call it value debate. A value is something like justice, morality, societal progression, rights. Some general, rather philosophical underpinning to what we're trying to achieve in our actions toward the resolution. The value is the underlying reason for a position. As I said, values are highfalutin things like justice. How do we achieve justice? Well, there we have what we call a criterion. That's how we get to the value. So in any debate round, the debater will say what his value is or her value, and then will tell you a criterion by which for you to judge whether or not they achieve the value. Now let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here. What is the value of an automobile? The value of an automobile is transportation. A car gets you from one place to another. But your criteria for buying cars can be radically different depending on certain factors in your life and situation. You may have as your number one reason for buying a car, aside from the fact that it's transportation, but the kind of car that you're going to get. You're going to buy a kind of car because you have a large family, therefore you need a minivan. Or you have, the number one concern that you have is the environment, and so you'll buy a environmentally sound car, high mileage car. Or maybe you are a single, sexy teenager, and you want to go out there and pick up members of the opposite sex, in which case you get yourself a little sports car. That's the example I use for the kids. Anyhow, all of these things are cars, and they're all going to transport you, so you're always going to achieve the value of transportation, but the criteria are different. The safety, or the number of people, or the environmental soundness or the sexiness of the vehicle. And then I'm going to make arguments in favor of those criteria, because we know we're going to get the transportation, so I'm going to argue about those criteria. Another example of a value and criterion discussion is a vacation. Why do you take a vacation? A vacation is for rest and relaxation, but we all define R&R differently. Some people R&R is sitting on the beach for 2 weeks, or going camping, which is much more active, or walking around in cities and going to museums and restaurants and all this sort of stuff. They're all vacations. They're all R&R, but each one is different. And if I were going to argue in favor of my vacation, it would be in favor of what the one of those, the beach or the camping or the city that I like. And those would be where my arguments would be. So my arguments would support my criterion to achieve my value, which is rest and relaxation, the way I define it. So anyhow, the value and criterion work together. The criterion is a way of getting to the value, or evaluating the value. Or as we sometimes say, weighing the round. The criterion can be a weighing mechanism. Anyhow, the arguments of each side should support the criterion, which leads to the value. Now, in a debate, those things we were talking about before, those LD topics like capital punishment and no government versus bad government, maybe a criterion might be the most protection of rights. I protect rights best. Whoever protects rights best, that'll be the criterion, achieves the value of justice best. So we both agree to this, both sides agree to this. So as a judge, you're going to say, okay, whose arguments sound to me like they are going to protect the most rights? Now, obviously, it's very simple, or at least simplest, if both sides are trying to achieve the same value through the same criterion, then you can really concentrate on their arguments. But there is no rule that they have to attempt to achieve the same value, nor do they have to achieve the same criterion. Their debating skill will explain to you how to evaluate their criterion and their value. And this is so important that we consider this the number one thing in a debate round. Who has won that value argument? Who has achieved their value through their criterion? So if, in fact, they explained this to you very clearly, and you buy what they say on one side and not what they say on the other side, remember, the whole point here was for them to convince you, then your decision's clear, even if they have different values and different criteria, or the same value and different criteria to achieve that value. This is a tough concept, though. Toughest concept of all. Because you're not used to this. It's not a bad way to handle a debate round. And in fact, you'll find very quickly that this makes debate judging rather simple. But from the sound of it, it sounds a little hard. Trust me on it, though. It's not quite as hard as it sounds. So what you're doing, in a nutshell, once the round starts, is you're judging their argumentation. You're judging their arguing. It goes back and forth like a boxing match. Who connected with the most punches? Who flailed around in the air? Not the one who looked good. Not the guy you like best because he's from Brooklyn. It's the guy who fought better. The guy who debated better. And this brings up two important points. First of all, it is not an oratorical activity alone. We do ask that people speak well, and we're actually going to rate their speaking. But what they say counts more than how they say it. So if they sound like James Earl Jones, they don't automatically win against somebody who sounds like, well, someone who doesn't sound like James Earl Jones. There are activities, in fact, that do measure speaking voice, projection, and all that sort of stuff. We're not doing that. As long as they're clear enough for you to understand them, that's the important thing. The second thing is we do not go by our own opinions. You go into the debate round, your opinion on the subject doesn't matter. Like some of those subjects I mentioned, like capital punishment is a really good example. You may have an opinion on capital punishment. I'm sure you do. Doesn't matter. For the 45 minutes that you're listening to these debaters, you have no opinion except to listen to them and make your judgment based on what they say. Here's the acid test. If you had to act right now on this resolution, if you were the president or the king or the emperor or whatever it is, and you had to make a determination right now after listening to these two debaters, based on what you just heard, what would you do? Ask yourself that question after every round. You're going to make good decisions. Because that's what they should be convincing you, that if you could, if you had the power to act on this ethical question, how would you act? Let's look a little bit at the mechanics of the round. Here I'm going to ask you to look at the PDF that's on the website. Now the website, if you don't have it in front of you, is www.jimmenick.com/mhl/judge.html. So you go to my website, the jimmenick.com website, go to the MHL link. On the MHL link, you'll find a judge page link, and on the judge page, you will find all these materials. Now, one of these materials is a PDF of a flow. And this shows you how the round breaks down. It also shows you how to flow the round. Now, the first part, the first speech in a debate round is called the first affirmative. We abbreviate this 1AC, first affirmative constructive. This is a 6-minute speech. The affirmative will get up there and present their arguments. They'll usually start off by telling you what their value is and what their criterion is to achieve that value. They might give you some explanation of how their criterion and value work, and then they will give you arguments in favor of their side. My first area of analysis, my first contention, something like that. Or I have only one contention, and they will tell you what that is, and then they will proceed to explain it. As they talk, they may give you some evidence to support what they're saying. It could be factual evidence. It could be quotes from someone else, a philosopher or something like that, on their side. But they will do their best to explain how they can achieve this criterion, and that criterion will achieve the value. At the end of this 6 minutes, there will be a short cross-examination period. The negative will stand up and address questions to the affirmative. By the way, they will be looking at you during this, not looking at each other. They will be looking at you. You're the only one who counts in the round. They'll be looking at you and asking questions of each other. And the questions could be anything they wish the questions to be. It's clarification of what's already been said. The negative might want to set up some material for his own or her own case. Whatever. They're free to do whatever. As a general rule, we don't usually rate the cross-examination. We listen to it to find out where it's going to go. But aside from, are they polite to each other? It's more a chance for them to get their ducks in a row, to organize themselves, to clarify certain things. Listen to it. You might get something out of it that's useful. But as I say, it's more for them than for you. The next thing we have is a little preparation time. Now, in a given debate round, they have 3 or 4 and sometimes 5 minutes of preparation time for each side. And they can take that time whenever they want to take it. And as a general rule, they take it after cross-examination. They'll take half of it then, and then they'll take half of it later. So usually now the negative will sit down and take some preparation time. Eventually, they'll stand up, and then they will do the NC, the negative constructive. Now, the first part of the negative constructive is going to be a constructive case, a case just like the affirmative had. And this is going to go in that bottom part of the flow, okay? Put that in the bottom part of the flow there. And this is on that second box from the left, second over from the left and one down. This is where the negative would go. And as I say, they're going to have a case just like the affirmative had. They'll have a value, they'll have a criterion, and then they will have contentions. When they are finished presenting their side, they will go straight to refuting the affirmative side. So this would be at the top box above the one where we just wrote their constructive. Here, we would put their answers to the affirmative arguments. They will literally go down the flow, that's what we call it, go down the flow, and respond to each of the arguments that the affirmative made. Or they won't. They'll miss some. Maybe they'll miss some, in which case it starts to get a little easier for you to judge because, hey, you didn't cover this, but beside the point. At the end of this negative constructive, which takes 7 minutes, the affirmative was 6 minutes, the negative is 7 minutes because they have to do two things, the affirmative will stand up and cross-examine the negative. This is a 3-minute speech. The other cross-ex was also 3 minutes, exact same idea as the previous cross-examination. At the end of which everybody sits down, the affirmative will take some prep time, and then when they decide that they're ready, they stand up and have the first affirmative rebuttal, the 1AR. This is a 4-minute speech in which they've got to cover everything the negative said and everything the affirmative said. Now, it's hard to do, so they're probably going to group some things together, where they're going to eliminate some things that aren't important. A lot of judgment and decision-making goes into a 1AR. Very important speech. But again, it's pretty much going to be that line-by-line going down the flow. They're going to tell you why they win. They're going to tell you why the other side lost. But they're going to do it on a line-by-line basis. Sit down after that 4 minutes. Negative will take some prep time. The negative is going to do the NR, or 1NR, the negative rebuttal. This is a 6-minute speech. In that 6 minutes, they're going to defend their own case against what the affirmative said. They're going to re-attack the affirmative. And at the end, they're probably going to crystallize, summarize why they think they won the round. At the end of the 6 minutes, another little bit of prep time for the affirmative. The affirmative now has a 3-minute wrap-up called the 2AR, second affirmative rebuttal. They may or may not continue to argue some of the lines of argumentation that have already been brought up, or they may simply go straight into crystallization, summarization, and tell you why they think they won the round. By the way, keep in mind that we cannot be having new arguments this late in the game. New in the two, we call it. The affirmative can't get up here and come up with a whole new batch of arguments. Because obviously, the round is over, the negative can't respond to them. So if, in fact, the affirmative does say something new, comes up with a new argument, you have to ignore it. So you're looking at that sheet, I hope, that PDF. How do you exactly do you create one of these? Now, I do it on a legal pad. I turn a legal pad sideways, and I make those boxes, those 10 boxes. Kids do it differently, by the way. Don't listen to them. For you, as a parent, judge, learning to flow rounds, this is a really good way to start out. You could evolve into something else later on, but trust me, this is good because you have it all right in front of you when you do it like this. You don't have to flip pages. So when you write down whatever it is you can, you write down as much of what was said as possible. This is just note-taking. I can't tell you how to do it any more than the obvious. Just take notes. What you're looking for on that flow, when all is said and done, is a couple of things. First of all, you're looking for them not dropping an argument. A dropped argument is an argument that simply is forgotten in the round. Now, here's how a drop works. Like, let's say a debater says something. First debater says something. Blah, 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 blah. If the second debater doesn't say anything to it, and the first debater doesn't say anything more about it, whatever it was is out of the round. It doesn't matter. It's gone. So the fact that something was said and seems to disappear is to no one's benefit and to no one's disadvantage. It just is what happens. You know, there's only so much you can talk about in a round. But let's say that the first debater says something and the second debater doesn't respond, and the first debater goes back and does what we call pulling that across. The first debater goes and says, you know, this was an important point. My opponent did not respond to this, and let me tell you why it's important. And then they do. In that case, whatever it was said just categorically belongs to that first debater. You don't have to agree with it. It doesn't even have to be that good an argument. It can be, actually can be a totally bad argument. But if, in fact, it was not responded to, I mean, by the rules such as they are of debate, any argument that was not responded to that is, in fact, pulled across by that first debater is a winning argument. This is sort of like boxing. And I mentioned boxing before, but you know, if you're flailing around, and this is one of those points that nobody ever responds to, and that doesn't count for anybody. If I punch you and I hit, well, that counts as a point for me. Whereas if I attempt to punch you, but that punch is blocked, that's a draw. If I attempt to punch you, the punch is dropped, and there is a counterpunch that comes from the other side, then the point goes to the opponent. Arguing is the same way. If a point is blocked, if I say something and you say something, I say something, you say, we don't go anywhere. But if I say something, you say something, but you say something even better to turn around my argument, to win over that argument, a counterpunch, then you'll win the point. As I say to debaters, I say yes, you say no. We haven't gotten anywhere. I say yes, you say no, but now we're getting somewhere. For example, you are a parent. You tell your child, you cannot go to R-rated films because they are not suitable for you at your age. If your child makes no answer, you've won the point. If your child makes the answer, it is too suitable. It is suitable. It's not suitable. It is suitable. It's not suitable. We haven't really gotten anywhere. You're going to win because you're the parent. If you say to your child that you can't go to those movies because they're not suitable, and if your child says, well, actually, according to the Catholic News, this particular movie was recommended, despite the fact that it does not appear to be suitable, this was in the May 13th edition, they win. So that's how a debate ought to be. It's not yes, no, yes, no. It's yes, no, but. Yes, but. Listen for the buts. There's also other authoritarian said so. Obviously, in the R-rated film, parent says so. Parent sort of gets to win. In debate rounds, sometimes kids will say, a philosopher said so. Kant said so. Habermas said so. Derrida said so. Mill said so. Somebody said so. I don't care that somebody said so. This is an argument from authority. You have to tell me why I have to accept that authority. what makes what they said true. And here's a word that you're going to hear kicked around a lot by debaters. Usually they're going to kick it around without having a clue themselves what it means, but they're going to be talking about the warrant. What is the warrant for the claim? What is the reason this claim is true? Listen to what they're saying. Are they just saying a lot of stuff, or are they giving you some real practical reason, some kind of reason that makes sense beyond just saying it? That's the warrant. So and 90% of all people who smoke cigarettes die of cigarette-related illnesses. It's a pretty good warrant for making a claim that you ought to quit smoking. You know, as compared to, I don't like smoking. Yeah, well, fine. You know, it's not a good warrant for telling someone to quit smoking. Your job after listening to all of these is, well, to try to weigh what happened. Let me go back, first of all, to that value thing. Did their arguments support that criterion? We make sure, you know, we'll assume that the criterion does support the value. So were their arguments actually talking about why that car is going to save gas and be environmentally sound? Are they really making the arguments that connect to their criterion? And if so, were they good arguments? You're also going to be looking at all those drops, and especially with younger debaters. You're going to be judging the younger debaters, by the way, because we're going to put you there. We want you to judge them. Those are the rounds you can do the best. So we're going to put you there. We're not going to put you into a round with two varsity debaters who have a lot of experience, are going to talk really fast. We're just not going to do that. We know who you are. We're going to make sure you're in a round you can judge. So you're going to look at these drops, and you'll see a lot of drops. And you know, if somebody says a lot and the other person said nothing, it's sort of an easy round to adjudicate. So you're going to write up your ballot at the end of the round. Now, as I said, number one thing would be achieving the value through the criterion. If they don't do that, and one of them doesn't do it and one of them does, it's pretty much a given for that side. If they both do it, you have to look at some other things. Whoever does it the best obviously still becomes the winner. So you're looking for good arguments that convince you. That thing I said before, what would you do if you had to walk out of this round now and either legalize or ban capital punishment? So the more on the side that convinces you, the better. Judge adaptation, remember, that's their job. They have to convince you. You know, you have to give some stuff to them, but they've got to give a lot more to you. Another thing you're going to look for is those technical ideas where a lot of things dropped. How important is the argument? I mean, it's like some silly thing. It doesn't really, it's not relevant. It's not related. As I said before, do not look for the excellent speaker. We're looking for the excellent arguer. And there is a difference. Nonetheless, we do give speaker points. Those speaker points are a misnomer. Those speaker points really are debater points. How well they debated. And what we have here is sort of a continuum from really crappy to unbelievably smart and good. Usually at the beginning of a tournament, you will be told by the tournament directors what the span of points is. At Mid-Hudson League tournaments, at Catholic Forensic League tournaments, what we say is to use a grade point concept. Now, the points look like they range from 20 to 30. I'm sorry, no. Actually, they look like they range from 0 to 30, but in fact, they range from 20 to 30. And I think you should look at them like this. 29, 30, that's an A. A 30, by the way, you wouldn't be giving out a lot of 30s. A 30 would be the best of the day. You can only have one best of the day. So you may give out a 30. You may not ever get anybody that's all that good. The 30 is the smartest kid you've ever seen in your life. You would like that kid to be your kid. Okay, that's a 30. 27, 28 is pretty good. Covered a lot of stuff. Didn't really miss anything much. A little bit missed a few. It could have been a little better. 26, that's a C. That's a C. You know, they had their stuff, but they weren't great. 25, 24, they really looked like they weren't particularly prepared. They were too nervous, they didn't know what they were saying. Sometimes a kid will read a case, and you can tell that it's not their case because they mispronounce all the words. They really don't know what they're talking about. It's somebody else's case. below that 24 points. And again, this is only in the CFL MHL world. You might get a different span from a given tournament. Feel free to ask them what their span is. You want to be with the program. In our area, below that 24 is rude behavior, unacceptable behavior. You're going to give a real low point ballot. You know, 20 points, 22 points, something like that. There has to be a good reason for it. Rude during the cross X, you know, things like that. Those would be the reasons for those really low points. We do ask that in the ballot you are helpful. Now, obviously, the debaters want to know why they won or lost, so we ask you to put down a reason for the decision. Here's why I voted for this side or that side. But if you see things that would help them, and again, you're judging younger kids, newer kids, so the advice that you give them is real-world advice that anybody ought to give them that's good for them to have. So, you know, stand up straight. Don't talk so fast. Don't mumble. Don't stand still. Please stand still. Don't shuffle. Take your hands out of your pockets. Take your hat off. I mean, whatever. Yeah, those are, you know, good pieces of advice for any debater. One important thing I do ask is that you be where we can find you at a debate tournament. There are a handful of places we're going to look for judges. Judges Lounge is one of them. The auditorium or cafeteria where everybody's hanging out is another. Please don't go wandering off. Even though you can, you're an adult, no one's going to stop you from doing it. When we're looking for people, we're looking for people. And sometimes we're looking for people when you don't expect us to be looking for people because someone didn't show up for a round or something like that. So we do ask that you remain available to us. There really is nothing else to do at a debate tournament except participate in the debate, and we ask you to do this. I know that a lot of parents are worried about judging. And they're worried because they say, I don't want to make the wrong decision. But you can't make the wrong decision because, by definition, you're the decider. I hate to say that, but it's true. This activity was created for the decision maker, for the judge, for the lay judge, for the parent adjudicator. Kids have to adapt to you. They have to adjust to you. They have to win your ballot, not the other way around. You don't have to learn a lot of arcane stuff. They have to learn a lot of normal stuff. But nonetheless, you need confidence. You need confidence. And there are ways of getting that confidence. Obviously, listening to this lecture and trying to absorb what I've been saying. There's also a manual. And then that same place on that same judging page, I have a written manual that is very useful for going through and then going over again some of the things that I've been saying here. But there's also, and this is the best thing of all to build your confidence, the best thing to make you a good judge, and that is follow through. Start judging now. Your kids, when they start out, are 13, 14-year-old freshmen in high school. They're novices. And I guarantee that you know more than them about everything, including Lincoln Douglas debate. They may not buy this, but trust me. We're all starting at the same point if you start judging them when they're novices. Learn with them. Go every few weeks, maybe once a month, something like that. Maybe once every 2 months, but go there, learn how to do it. Pay attention, go in there and judge, because I don't need you just this year. I'm going to need you for 4 years. We're all going to need you for 4 years. Learn with them, and you'll be comfortable judging anybody. There are some parent judges who have been judging, starting as novices. Some schools have a lot of parents that show up. Those parents, I will put them in any round. I will, in the tab room, because I run the tab rooms, I will comfortably put them in any round, knowing they will make a good decision, regardless of who's debating at what level. And because they've been doing it so long, they're comfortable on their side, judging regardless of who it is they're judging at what level. By the way, Keep in mind that if your kid does become a debater, this is going to be the most important activity both socially and intellectually for them for their high school career. The most important activity. And as a parent judge, you can be a small but important part of it. By the way, when you do go to tournaments and when you are a parent judge, you're not in your kid's face, and the kids aren't in your face. This is not a problem where you're some kind of intrusive character that, you know, that's uncomfortable or that it makes other people feel uncomfortable. It does not happen. You are going to be honored by your team, your kids and their teammates, because they need you and they're thankful for you being there. I don't know where it came from, but I've never seen, when I've gone on a debate tournament, when there have been parents on the trip with us, the kids automatically, without any encouragement from me, always, as the parents are leaving, thank them for judging. You know, they're just so thankful that they were there. It's not like some artificial thing where they had to learn their manners. They really mean it. They really thank you for doing it. And as I said, I've never really had a good debater, never really seen a good team that didn't have strong parental support, except in those few cases where, in fact, they do spend as much money as they do on a football team, and they hire 10 coaches or something like that. There are places that do that. We don't. Around here, that just doesn't happen. There is another useful document on that judge page, and it's a letter from one of my parents. And she wrote this, that I think you should take a look at this. This really summarizes what it means to be a parent judge. In keeping with this letter, there's one last thing I would ask of you, in addition to your volunteering to judge, and that is to continue to give your debate kids encouragement. I know a lot of parents will tell their kids, oh, everything in life is not a debate. But if you're an adolescent and you're a debater, to some extent everything in life is a debate, and they are arguing and trying positions and just trying to get good at thinking about stuff. They will, in fact, get good at thinking about stuff and presenting a position, but one of the things that you have that they don't have is worldview tempered by experience and knowledge. They are kids, and they're going to be judged by parents, so a new topic will come along, and you know stuff about this topic that they don't know. Like capital punishment, for instance, or invading foreign countries and things like that. I mean, when we talk about invading foreign countries, our kids will think about Iraq. They won't think about Grenada. They won't think about Vietnam. They won't think about a lot of things that you may have some information on. You can point them in directions that they might not otherwise see. You can argue with them at the dinner table. I tell my kids that they should be discussing the topics with their family, not because they want to agree on stuff, but so that they can just hear more opinions on what it is that we're discussing. So I ask you, when you're having these discussions with the kids, not to categorically tell them, well, this is right or this is wrong. You are the moral authority. There's no question about that. You have been their moral authority, but we're not really discussing this in a moral authority point of view. We're discussing this from an intellectual point of view. Put aside what's right and what's wrong. Help them look at subjects from all directions. And that's about it. I really appreciate your giving me this time. I do hope that you will take a look at the various materials that we've put out there to read. If you have any questions, when you come to tournaments, we do have more training. We certainly encourage questions from parents about how to judge. We encourage you to judge. So good luck in your judging career.